Welcome to the 5Cs podcast. I'm your host, Charlene Norman, and this is where we talk all things clarity and collaboration for the community of climate change makers. Last week, we launched a new series examining how marketing and advertising shaped our current reality. We explored the origins of the recycling movement, and we wrapped up playing my favorite game, What If? Finding the right guest for this conversation felt like striking gold. John Gorman brings a rare combination of marketing excellence and psychological insight to the table. He's young enough to view legacy systems with fresh eyes, yet seasoned enough to understand their mechanics very deeply. What sets John apart is his dispassion toward how things have always been done, paired with genuine fire for helping organizations reimagine their market approach entirely. His credentials speak volumes: a trophy case of industry awards, a celebrated body of work on Medium, and the distinction of serving as ghostwriter and copywriter for two powerhouse Democratic leaders. He's also traded the traditional agency grind for life on his own terms in Puerto Rico, which somehow feels perfectly on brand. You'll find John's contact information in the show notes, and if you're looking to craft messaging, branding, marketing strategy, business strategy that breaks the mold, I cannot recommend him highly enough. Today's episode is something special. John's going to pull back the curtain on Truck Month, that perennial marketing phenomenon most of us are not aware of, and share some insider truths about how automakers actually operate. So, John, tell me the story about trucks.
It's that time of year. In the U.S., it's always that time of year. Autumn's in the air, there's football on TV, and there's bales of hay and harvest to be lugged around. I've asked myself, at least as I've been watching linear television where they're still advertising, is it truck month every month? What is a truck month? It's one of our great American mysteries. And I happen to solve it. Truck month is a series of ads that started in the early 1990s by Ford Motor Company. And they were struggling to move some pickups. They already had the best-selling truck, but they were like, well, what if we could sell more trucks? And so in 1991, Ford and their ad, J. Walter Thompson, which became later GTP, again, not interesting for the sake of the podcast, but just to know that this is an ad-based, an advertising-based initiative, they came up with this idea for Truck Month, which was this idea that in 1 month out of the year, they were going to feature trucks. And so they picked a month and they settled on March. Eventually, they tried it in different months, you know, October, November, August, February. They decided on March and then early April. And they decided that this is when we're going to really blast trucks. Like we're going to try and move trucks here in this month. And you're thinking like, well, okay, why then? And the reason for that is because that is when Americans get their tax refunds back. The tax system is set up here as every family pays taxes. Generally, we overpay because they're withheld from our paycheck throughout the year. And then so we get whatever we overpaid back in a refund. The average American tax refund is about $3,000 USD. That's the perfect down payment if you're going to treat yourself to a car or, in this case, a truck. And so they loved using the term truck month because the name is, you know, catchy and it was blunt. And it was like, okay, we're this month trucks. And it's also too generic to get trademarked or copywritten. And I want you to remember that when I tell you the rest of this story. So about a decade later, seeing the success of Ford's truck month, the F-150 is by far the most widely sold truck in America.
I think it still is, isn't it?
Yes, it still is. GM, General Motors, saw this fake holiday, and they were like, well, I guess we're going to do us a truck month. And so, and then Ram, which is a Chrysler company, piled in. Nissan and Toyota did too. And truck month lasted longer than a month, usually two, always during tax season. And so the way that American advertising, as it pertains to brand marketing initiatives in the auto industry, is set up is these corporations would create their month of truck month, but then they were like, well, okay, so now that we've established what our visual identity and verbal identity and messaging and the structure of our deal setup is for the year, we're going to roll this out to our like regional and our local partners, and they can do truck month on their own. So they greenlit local dealers to do this and slap it on their own promos whenever their lots, you know, were filling up with too many trucks. But the funding wasn't bound to the same calendar as they were at the corporate level, which meant all of these dealers could just run truck month whenever they wanted to locally. And so as long as the creative aligned and they were selling trucks, they would get recompensated for all the trucks they sold. And it's not a sale. Truck month is what is called a branded incentive burst, which is this idea that you just run a whole bunch of ads for like 6 to 8 weeks and make it impossible to ignore. And that's true in the U.S. because 60% of all truck ads in the U.S. are truck month branded. And you don't get like a real sale as a consumer. You get an offer of like 5K off. Like you don't get 5K off MSRP. You get like 0% off APR if you qualify. Or you get a big rebate, but only on specific VINs. Or you get bonus cash if you buy specific trims. And they make it so you almost never get these deals when you walk into a lot and buy a truck. But the burst worked because it got you onto the lot. As long as you're test drive, and you're infinitely more likely to be buying a truck or even a car if you test drive, then the ad worked, even if you don't necessarily get the sale. Or they could move the numbers around so it looked like you were getting an even better deal. And you might be thinking to yourself, well, why would you advertise with trucks? Don't more people buy cars? They did, because the dirty secret about trucks is that they're cash cows, the American motor industry. 82% of all truck sales are retail. That means individual consumers, not like corporate fleets. But on a per vehicle basis, full-size pickups are 5 times more profitable than the median sedan.
5 times more profitable?
Yeah. So, you know, obviously there's a wholesale value for a truck and a car, right? Like, let's say, for example, a car is $20,000, a truck is $20,000. And this is funny math, but just go with it. If that's, let's say both get sold at wholesale for $20,000 a pop. People don't know how to price a truck in their own heads. Like the individual consumer doesn't know what a truck should cost. They know what a car should cost. We've seen a bunch of car ads in our lifetime. We don't know what a truck should cost. And so you can mark up a truck way more than you can mark up a car. And so what ends up happening is a car is usually sold at like a 3% markup to the individual consumer. A truck can be sold at about 15%. And so you can run more sales, bigger sales, more often on trucks than you can with cars, and still not eat into your profit margin. And so it works. And so to give you an idea of how well truck month has worked, 50 years ago, trucks and SUVs comprised about 19% of all U.S. vehicle sales. Last year, 4 out of every 5 vehicles sold to an individual consumer was a truck or an SUV. The percentage of car to truck SUV has inverted in the last 50 years. And much of that has been in the last 15. So why do we have a truck month? Why is every month truck month? Because the more people you can get to buy a truck versus a car, the more profitable your business will be. The future of cars is trucks.
It's all about the corporate profits. Every last thing is always about corporate profits. It's never, ever about giving a decent transaction for the consumer.
Look, there is no incentive for a corporation, particularly an established one in a saturated market like the automotive industry, to eat into their margin.
I think these two examples that you've provided are incredible examples of what I call shame-based marketing. Can you tell me why, for so long, this has worked so damn effectively?
Yeah. Shame-based marketing. And this is something that I want to be clear when I say this, because, again, you have a global audience. Not every society is a shame-based society. Not every culture is a shame-based culture. Some are guilt-based, some are collectivist, some are actualist. Like, there's different cultures have different means of persuasion on a tacit, on a primordial level.
The emotions that you're actually talking about are fundamentally negative.
Yes, because ultimately you have to get people to conform if you want to have a society or a civilization, right? You're familiar with the concept of like ask people versus guess people?
No, please share.
The way in which that gets delineated is often through the idea of someone traveling and from out of town into a town. So let's say you fly from where you live to San Francisco and you have a friend who lives in San Francisco and you tell that friend, hey, I'm coming to San Francisco. The ask person would follow that up with, mind if I stay at your place? The guest person would think to themselves internally, well, if they want to be me, they'll invite me to stay at their place. An ask person has no quarrels about imposing or feeling as though they've imposed. They'll just simply like, if I need a favor done, I'll ask for it. Versus a guest person who will say, well, if somebody really wants to help, I can just say what I need and they'll offer. Why do I bring that up? A guilt-based society fundamentally produces more ask people. A shame-based society fundamentally produces more guess people. So shame-based societies are you know, I don't want to be seen asking for help, or a guilt-based society will yield more people being like, well, I can't turn down a favor when it's asked of me. That's important for how we're going to set up the marketing. So shame-based marketing, the persuasive tactic that leverages, you know, feelings of shame or embarrassment or fear or fraudulence to manipulate people into purchasing a product or a service. So what it does is it highlights a consumer's perceived insecurities or flaws and then presents the product or the solution to these problems. So if you're concerned about being called a litter bug and recycling is being pitched as a solution, you're going to be more interested in recycling as a means of assuaging yourself from the feelings of shame you might have if you're the one person who doesn't do this thing that supposedly we all do. So it creates this sense of need or urgency. The problem with a shame-based marketing is that, generally speaking, while effective in the short term, in the long term, it yields to decreased participation, more negative brand perception. It leads many people to feel that it's unethical. If we were shamed into recycling in the United States, which we have been over the last 50 years, would we have been so interested in finding out that plastic recycling essentially doesn't exist, right? There have been studies done. There have been surveys done. Like, essentially, when you put your plastic in a recycling bin,
90% of it is not being recycled. It's going to the landfill.
Right. And a lot of us as consumers are, you know, or as concerned citizens are probably thinking like, well, gosh, like I'm kind of tired of putting my plastics in a recycling bin when it just doesn't feel like it's doing anything. Shame-based behavioral modification is one of those things where like the reason we don't have mass transit in the United States, right, is because we're not shaming people into riding the train. That's not a thing that would work because there's no incentive for the car industry, they of Truck Month, who very clearly don't much care if they're putting emissions into the air. There's no incentive for them to be like, hey, think about riding the train. But there is shame-based marketing in all kinds of, you know, we think of the stigma that's attached to things like mental health or infertility or drug use.
We treat everyone like a loser. They're the problem.
Think of obesity, right? The GLP-1 drugs that have come out. That's classic shame-based marketing. Not overtly, right? No pharmaceutical country sits there and says, hey, you tired of being fat and lazy? But the culture itself, whether in media or entertainment or what have you, peer-to-peer, social media, you know, we have enough body dysmorphia in this country to power the country for the next 300 years. If it's that easy for you to lose weight, what excuse do you have for not doing that? You don't want to be the one person left who's obese. And so this, again, rather than, you know, perhaps having a food supply that's more based in actual food, which would be a systemic solution to a systemic problem.
That is true.
No, stab yourself with this thing that we don't know the long-term effects of, and that will stop working the instant you stop stabbing yourself. It's wild. That's our marketing system.
Well, that was eye-opening, wasn't it? The pattern is unmistakable. Profit drives every decision. Shame-based marketing proves devastatingly effective. The formula never changes. Attract more customers, sell more products, and above all, preserve the existing system structure at any cost. I challenge anyone to identify an industry that hasn't followed this exact playbook. Extract whatever resources are available, manufacture whatever yields the highest margins, externalize every negative consequence onto consumers, and obscure the corporation's true impact beyond layers of misdirection. Is it any wonder marketing and advertising today has lost its edge? And that's what we'll talk about next week. But let's return to that what-if game for a moment. What if companies had recognized that despite oil's apparent abundance, it remains fundamentally finite? What if they had voluntarily capped their profit margins and invested those resources into sustainable innovation decades earlier? What if corporate mandates prioritized employee well-being and community health over quarterly returns and shareholder dividends? Because the truth is, we're all living with the unintended consequences of actions we and everyone else have taken collectively over the last 100 years. And most of them haven't been right. And today we're shaking our heads going, what on earth were they thinking? How could we all fall for such stupid things? And wouldn't it be great to do a do-over? But you and I are sometimes smart, and we both know that do-overs are a fantasy. The only thing we can do now is to do better. And that do better absolutely must be in the highest good for all.